we don't think we're going to run out of gas anytime soon. How long the party can last, I don't know. Depends how successful we are.
What the oil and gas renaissance in Cook Inlet means for South Central Energy Supplies. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, December 19th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Unalaska residents get creative to lure an eagle out of the grocery store.
The theory was that the birds don't like the darkness, so he'd stay with the light. And the light was going towards this back door by the auto parts.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. And by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
In Washington, D.C., the buzz around the Capitol is that the White House is going to nominate Montana Senator Max Baucus to be ambassador to China. His departure with a year left on his term would trigger a domino effect in the Senate, advancing a few Democrats to key positions, and that could have big implications for Alaska. We've asked APRN's Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin to tell us about it. Hi, Liz.
Hi.
Liz, explain this domino effect among the Democratic senators.
Well, a domino effect, musical chairs, the theory goes like this. With Baucus out, Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon would likely give up his chairmanship of the Senate Energy Committee to take over the Finance Committee. And that would allow Senator Mary Landrieu of Louisiana to claim the top seat on energy.
So what would this mean for Alaska?
Well, Lisa Murkowski is already the lead Republican on the Energy and Natural Resources Committee. Landrieu, like Murkowski, is also from an oil-producing state and is one of the most pro-industry senators the Democrats have. Together, Murkowski and Landrieu could really pull that committee in a direction that favors oil and gas development in terms of regulation, oversight, opening more land and water to exploration. The two of them co-sponsored, for instance, a revenue-sharing bill so that states could benefit from energy development off their shores and thus would be more inclined to press the feds for offshore development.
Where does Senator Landrieu stand on allowing development in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge?
Well, she has voted with the Alaska delegation in the past to open ANWR. But the issue has a lot of opposition in the Senate. As long as Democrats control the Senate and the White House, the ANWR bill isn't likely to go anywhere.
Outside of the Energy Committee, what are other implications of the shakeup? Could it help Democrats hold on to their leadership of the Senate after the 2014 election?
Well, yes, it does seem like it could be a help to the Democrats. Politically, it's a pretty brilliant move for the White House. Baucus was planning to leave the Senate next year anyway, but his leaving early gives the governor of Montana, also a Democrat, a chance to fill the seat for a year, and that could give a candidate a big head start in terms of fundraising and name recognition and just looking senatorial. And Mary Landrieu was considered one of the most at-risk Democrats in the Senate for 2014. If she gets to chair Senate Energy, she has a chance to raise a lot more money for her campaign, and she's seen as that much more valuable to one of the largest industries in her state. So just like that, the White House can boost Democratic candidates in Montana and Louisiana, two states where Republicans thought they had the advantage.
Liz, is this all a done deal?
Not at all. The White House hasn't even announced its nomination of Baucus officially, and then Landrieu is not the most senior Democrat on the Energy Committee. But if the chairmanships of other committees go as expected, she would be the likely one to inherit the energy gavel.
All right. Well, thanks for keeping an eye on this and giving us that update, Liz.
Thank you, Lori.
APRN's Liz Ruskin reporting from Washington, D.C. According to the state's Department of Revenue, Cook Inlet production increased by 13% last year. Hillcorp drilled 10 new wells there this year and refurbished more than 70 old ones. So does the Cook Inlet renaissance mean that South Central's energy woes are over? APRN's Ann Hillman reports.
Sitting in his warm office on a chilly Anchorage morning, John Sims looks at a brightly colored chart. He's the director of business development at NSTAR, the company that provides natural gas to heat the Anchorage area. The chart shows which petroleum companies have agreed to provide gas from Cook Inlet through the beginning of 2018.
And then here you can see the large black section, which represents that we have demand out there and we don't have a contract yet to meet that demand. So that's undesignated, and we're looking to fill that void there in 2018.
Sim says it used to be different. Large oil companies would contract to provide as much gas as NSTAR needed for 20 years or more. Now, he says they're in constant communication about the supplies. At this point, they have the next 4 years secured.
Yeah, it's 4 years, but still when you look at NSTAR's options outside of Cook Inlet, it's basically right on the verge of our comfort level.
That's because right now, the only other option is to import liquid natural gas. Setting that up takes between 3 to 5 years. Sim says what they need is new development in Cook Inlet, and Hillcorp, the company that took over Chevron and Marathon's old plays, says they're working on it. Greg Lehlacher is the president of Hillcorp. Speaking at the Resource Development Council meeting in Anchorage in November, he said they're moving ahead with developing the inlet's middle-aged fields. He said they would review the gas situation every year to see if they can meet the region's demands.
You know, we don't think we're going to run out of gas anytime soon. How long the party can last, I don't know. Depends how successful we are. But as long as we're keeping, you know, spending money and finding more, you know, rate reserves, we're going to keep trying to get it sold and, you know, move on down the line.
Most of their expanding production actually involves reworking old wells rather than doing new exploration. Other small companies, like Buccaneer and Fury, are also developing new areas. Pete Stokes, with Petrotechnical Resources of Alaska, has completed several studies on Cook Inlet production. He says the renaissance is completely dependent on small companies like these, who are partially motivated by the state's incentive package. Cook Inlet is insubstantial for the larger companies, but a significant investment for new independents. Stokes says exploration is happening now, but before anything big happens, companies need to secure a market.
Well, typically, if a company were to discover, say, gas in Cook Inlet, they would need to go and get investors to finance a development, and investors would want to know where they're going to sell their gas, and we are a fairly small gas market in Cook Inlet.
Without a larger market to sell to, there's no incentive to invest. That means no secure supply for South Central. But a solution may be on the horizon. ConocoPhillips filed an application this month with the Department of Energy to reopen the LNG export plant in Nikiski. Not everyone thinks that's the best solution, though, especially when the resource is needed locally. Bob Shivelson is with Cook Inlet Keeper. He thinks the state needs a better energy plan so supplies are more consistent and the state doesn't lose money.
And so now there's calls to reopen the LNG plant and to export this highly subsidized gas to Tokyo, where we'd sell it for probably a lower price than we're paying for it here. So it really makes no sense, and so it would behoove everyone in the state to have a sensible energy plan.
He said that plan needs to include renewable energy as well. Chugach Electric spokesperson Phil Steyer agrees. He says they primarily rely on natural gas, and they're confident that they can continue to depend on that resource for many years. But they would also like to diversify.
We're 10% hydro and 2% wind, and we have an interest from our boardroom in moving to more renewables in our portfolio.
Back at NSTAR, a natural gas supply company, a move towards renewables won't help anything. Sim says he's optimistic about the development he's seen lately in the inlet, but
activity doesn't really mean much to NSTAR unless they're willing to sign it on, ink it in a contract.
The president of Hillcorp said his company is planning to start talks again in April. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a state agreement that gives tribal government more authority over foster care.
Honestly, I think the big challenge that we had is we weren't focused on why we were doing it. And we lost track of the kids.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Premier Dental Group, providing full-service dental care for the entire family with three offices, two in Anchorage and one in Wasilla. Service information at smilealaska.com. And by Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
Tanana Chiefs Conference President Jerry Isaac and the head of the Health and Social Services Commissioner signed an agreement yesterday that will give TCC the lead role in managing foster care for tribal children. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
It was only fitting that the Fairbanks Native Association JOM dancers capped off Wednesday's ceremony in the Morris Thompson Cultural and Visitors Center. The occasion was all about preserving Alaska Native tradition and culture and celebrating the signing of a landmark agreement, which longtime TCC Administrator Don Schursel says will help Native foster kids stay in tribal homes located in their own communities.
It takes a village, and with the signing of this agreement, here in the interior, we are all now part of that village.
TCC President Jerry Isaac says the agreement, worked out over 23 years of negotiations, calls for the state to give his organizations more authority and about $400,000 annually to help Native kids stay in tribally licensed foster homes in the familiar surroundings of their villages.
The state is willing to cooperate with the tribes in the placement of children and using state resources to help offset costs of placement. So it is a very historic step forward.
Isaac says the new arrangement will help heal the cultural wounds Alaska Natives have suffered due to heavy-handed state and federal foster care policies of the past.
For many years, we've had the history of our children being removed from homes and placed into either adoption centers and or homes without much say from the Native community.
Isaacs says the agreement that he and State Health and Social Services Commissioner William Strewer signed is the first of its kind in the nation, and he says it will serve as a model for other Native organizations, both here in Alaska and the lower 48.
This one is specifically the Tanana Chiefs region, and it was crafted in a way that it could be exportable to other regions.
Isaac says the agreement also is historic because it represents a rare acknowledgement of tribal government's sovereign authority. Sovereignty has sparked many clashes between Alaska Native leaders and state officials over the years, and Isaac says he certainly has his differences with Governor Sean Parnell over the issue. But he gives credit to administration officials for maintaining a dialogue with TCC on the foster care issue. And Isaac hopes the benefits of the new policy will soon become evident, especially for the state agency that oversees foster care, the Office of Children's Services, or OCS.
Governor Parnell's administration has taken a huge step forward in trying to solve long-standing issues, because a lot of this stuff, that the problems that the OCS is having in terms of placement, identification of foster homes, visitation rights, all of this stuff could easily be handled by the villages, the tribes, and their tribal courts.
Strewer says he realized the advantages of tribal control over Native foster care soon after he took over at Health and Social Services 3 years ago. He says that was before he experienced the complex legal and political issues that negotiators had been working on since 1990. He thinks those issues too often have gotten in the way of the most important concern, which is helping children and families in trouble.
Honestly, I think the big challenge that we had is we weren't focused on why we were doing it. We were focused on everything else. We focused on why we couldn't do it. We focused on, well, the issues, whatever those may be, and we lost track of the kids.
OCS Director Christy Lawton says TCC manages foster care for about 150 kids right now. She says that number will grow to about 200 over the next 3 years as the new policy is phased in. I'm Tim Ellis in Fairbanks.
Earlier this month, the Alaska Division of Homeland Security and Department of Military and Veterans Affairs put out a request for proposals, or RFP, for contracts to set up an emergency food system. The plan is to stockpile food for 40,000 people at two separate locations in the state. KNOM's Zachariah Hughes reports.
McHugh Pierre is a deputy commissioner with the DMVA. He says the food stockpiles are one part in Governor Sean Parnell's recent steps to shore up emergency response measures across the state.
They've included emergency power electric generation. It includes water purification. And the last part is having an emergency food cache in the state.
Food security is the ability to respond to emergencies, and by that measure, Alaska has a long way to go. According to Pierre, the logistics of food delivery are complex and contingent, especially in communities far off the road system.
There's a lot of supply line vulnerability in Alaska. We have remote communities, and our largest communities are remote from other major shipping points in the world.
And at the state level, natural disasters are the norm. On average, Alaska declares about four a year. Pierre says even though disastrous events register as exceptional when they hit communities, the state's response needs to function like a routine.
They happen to us on a regular basis. On average, we have a declared disaster every 90 days, and we shouldn't wait around and be surprised by something that's predictable.
The state's RFP is seeking three separate contracts. One is for providing all the food that will be stored, and the other two are for the storage itself, one facility near Anchorage and another in Fairbanks. The state's plan is to stockpile enough food to feed 40,000 people three meals a day for a full week. And the state doesn't want to use military field rations like MREs because at a shelf life of 3 years, they won't last long enough. DHS's contracts require foods that can last a minimum of 5 years, but ideally for a full seven. The RFP also calls for foods that meet the needs of children and the elderly instead of just soldiers. This current system of stockpiling durable foods in a hub is the older industrial approach to food security, and in a state as spread apart and disaster-prone as Alaska, it may not be the best way of organizing emergency food systems. Darren Snyder works for UAF and is a governing board member for the Alaska Food Policy. He's happy with DHS's efforts, but says that preparedness should ideally start with knowing what food communities can get to themselves if cut off.
Communities don't have intentional amounts of food stored. We don't have any intentional amounts of food. So, you know, it would be luck of the draw. How much food is there stored in your community right now? What is your accessibility to the natural resources? If food stopped being shipped, doesn't that mean that fuel also would stop being shipped? And how will you harvest wild foods?
If multiple disasters were to compound food shortages in a crisis, or if weather kept DMVA from being able to access affected communities, then food stockpiled in Fairbanks or Anchorage would do little to help. An alternate model, Snyder suggests, would have communities identifying foods that are consistently coming in and rotating them through locally maintained reserves.
A community food cache system would be to increase the stocks of nutritionally qualified foods that are already coming through a community. They may come through a school lunch program or maybe just the stores, but just to increase the stocks of those foods to levels which address whatever that community's priority is for a certain number of meals.
At present, there is no way for assessing how much food a given community in Alaska has in it. Between freezers, stores, pantries, and community centers, nobody knows how long things could last if supply lines were suddenly shut down. And that not knowing, says Snyder, constitutes a hazard to food security in its own right.
My belief is that a community-level intentional planning is the only way that we can be truly emergency food prepared.
The estimated budget for DHS's three contracts is $2.5 million in total. In Nome, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Providence Imaging Center, helping cancer patients stay in Anchorage with a PET scanner that fuses anatomical and functional images since 2004. Learn more at provimaging.com. BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. and by First National Bank of Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for more than 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Anchorage-based General Communications Incorporated, or GCI, plans to deploy the state's first 1-gigabit internet service by January of 2015. Company officials say the move is in line with FCC requests to make faster broadband speeds available to consumers. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports.
GCI President and CEO Ron Duncan faced reporters at the company's training center this morning to announce its Fiber Red plan. In expanding GCI's fiber footprint, as Duncan calls it, the company will provide 1,000 megabits per second internet service. He says that's 100 times faster than the current national average.
You can save a lot of time, for starters. You can get your HD movie downloaded in 18 seconds instead of 30 minutes. Doesn't even leave you time to make the popcorn. You can download a console game in 33 seconds rather than 55 minutes.
Fast movie and games download speeds are no doubt attractive to consumers, but the eventual uses of ultra-high speed service could bring benefits to home health care and education services, as well as to small businesses, he said. Duncan said the 1-gigabyte service will be confined to Anchorage initially, but in 3 or 4 years it could expand to the state's other cities.
How people respond probably has an awful lot to do with how fast it goes to other communities. If there's an overwhelming response, it's a very popular product, people find lots of uses for it, then we're highly motivated to get quickly into the other road system communities.
Duncan says it is not foreseeable at this time to provide 1-gigabyte service to rural communities. He says the fiber plan will be paid for with private funds at an estimated cost of the $100 million it will take over the next few years to deploy it throughout Anchorage. Duncan says the 1-gigabyte plan fits with the FCC's vision that a vigorous internet backbone stimulates commerce by enabling new technologies. In 1999, GCI did not realize that 50% of the bits flowing through its network would eventually be used to stream movies. Now, instant on-demand use has driven the expansion of high-speed service. Right now, only about a dozen cities in the United States have residential 1-gig internet service. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Republican Oklahoma Senator Tom Coburn's annual Waste Book, released Tuesday, purports to document cases of wasteful federal spending. Number 59 in the 100-item list is a $450,000 federal grant awarded to Juneau's Alaskan Brewing Company. The Waste Book says the grant gives the already successful company a big profit boost courtesy of the federal government. The money covered a quarter of the cost of the brewing company's first-of-its-kind boiler that generates heat from the spent grains used to make beer.
So that was a significant risk to be the first, you know, brewery in the world to try this system, and the USDA's grant helped us mitigate a portion of that risk.
That's company spokesman Andy Klein. They're taking the listing in stride.
I think that it gives us an opportunity to talk about a project we're incredibly proud of. So, you know, I think that this guy has his opinion, but in fact, it's barely negative.
Klein says the environmental and federal government also benefit.
Part of the point of what the senator said is that we're a successful brand and we're enjoyed in 15 states, and we're happy with that success, and that success allows us to pay about $2 million annually in federal excise taxes. So on a dollar figure alone, the federal government's getting a pretty good return on that investment.
Klein says no one from the senator's office has contacted the company about the listing. Two other Alaska items made the wasteful spending list, the Denali Commission and the Kinnick Arm Bridge. A department store in Unalaska had an unwelcome customer for about 3 hours last night, a bald eagle, which flew in the loading door and refused to leave. The juvenile bird flew around the Alaska Ship Supply Store for about 3 hours before state troopers and employees were able to get it out. KUCB's Annie Ropeek has this report from the scene.
Maybe he just came to do some last-minute Christmas shopping, but the eagle seemed determined to stay flapping around in the rafters after he got inside Ship Supply around 6 p.m. State troopers and local public safety officers tried to scare the eagle down with noise. They clapped their hands and fired loud bursts of air at the eagle with a small air cannon. But the bird didn't seem to care. It knocked cans of spray paint off shelves, unhooked some aisle signs, and startled employees and customers. The store was open for business at the time, so they were all grouped by the front entrance. The eagle wreaked the most havoc in Ship Supply's liquor section. At one point, it fell from the rafters and smashed up some shelves of wine, as this employee found after the bird had flown away again.
Here! Oh, the expensive one!
State Trooper Tom Lowy says the bird did about $400 in damage in total. By hour three of the eagle's shopping trip, Lowy was wondering if it might not want to leave the brightly lit store for the nighttime darkness outside. So he hatched a plan.
We darkened as much of the store as we could, and then we left an area like a runway of lights, because the theory was that the birds don't like the darkness, so he'd stay with the light. And the light was going towards this back door by the auto parts.
The one lit up aisle was enough to guide the bird near the door. Then automotive employee Alex Mendegoren was able to capture it.
Here, I'm here, and then the bird, it's in the pipe, and then you just drop it here, and then I grab the net, then I grab it. That one is hard. It's too big.
With the eagle in the net, the troopers were able to get it outside, where it flew away. Trooper Lowy says this is the first time they've dealt with an eagle in a department store in Unalaska, but the birds have flown in warehouse doors at the post office before. He says stores should try to keep large loading doors shut when they're not using them, or risk inviting unwelcome feathered shoppers. In Unalaska, I'm Annie Ropeek.
You can see a video of the eagle roundup at our website, alaskapublic.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Zachariah Hughes in Nome, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Jeremy Shea in Juneau, and Annie Ropeek in Unalaska. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Juneau, and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Kristen Spack and Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. The Kinnickarm Bridge and Toll Authority is developing the Kinnickarm Crossing to further develop the transportation system between Anchorage and the Matsu Borough. The bridge could create construction jobs, provide access to land for commercial, industrial, and residential development, and shorten the route to Alaska's interior and North Slope. There's more information on the Kinnickarm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnickarm Bridge and Toll Authority. The Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority would like to recognize businesses and organizations that employ Alaskans who experience developmental disabilities, traumatic brain injuries, and mental health conditions. When you hire a Mental Health Trust beneficiary, you're not just providing a job, you're providing an opportunity to showcase unique skills, a strong work ethic, and a desire to succeed. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.